Welcome back to another episode of the Modern Multifamily Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Wolber, and I'm very excited to share this conversation with you today. Dom Beveridge is a principal over at 20 for 20 and an industry thought leader. And each year, he writes one of the most important white papers called 20 for 20. It's a sit-down interview where he talks to 20 executives at the pointy end of the industry to hear what's on their mind, what their outlook is for the year ahead, and how they're thinking about some of the biggest industry transformations that we all talk about every single day. This is the third time I've been able to host Dom for a recap of his white paper, and it did not disappoint. We talk about centralization, where the industry is at, and how the industry's thinking about it, the evolution of the tech stack, and some of the subpoints being how companies are thinking about segments like short-term rentals, AI, and even the evolution of technology acquisition and adoption. This conversation was fun, fast-paced, and I always learn a lot talking to Dom. I hope you enjoy this special conversation. Let's get into it. Dom, welcome back to Modern Multifamily. This is our third time doing this.
Yeah, good to be back.
I feel like you have been on a bit of a world tour the past couple months. I feel like you've done Denver, advocating for all things revenue management. You've been on a media tour. You've launched 20 for 20. How's the year starting for you?
The year's starting well. Yeah, the detour into state politics was unexpected and interesting. But the 20 for 20 media tour, such as it is underway. So lots of interesting conversations. I mean, I said that in the blog that launched this year's edition. It feels more and more like the start of a conversation that sort of goes on all year, really. It's good to be getting that underway.
I would love to start. I think, you know, the premise for 20 for 20 is pretty impactful. You sit down with 20 high profile executives each year to really talk through what the year ahead is going to look like. And you always look back a little bit as well. To start, I'm curious, like, you probably have a hypothesis about what you're going to hear from customers. Were you surprised in this year's findings? Like, what were some of the early thoughts as you started digging into the data from all these conversations?
So, I mean, there's always stuff that you didn't expect to hear. And the best things are usually the things where you realize you asked the wrong question. That usually tells you that you've learned something new. A couple of things we can dive into in more detail as we go on, but probably the biggest sort of standout things for me were, first of all, I had no idea that fraud and fraud prevention is as nationwide of a problem as it seems to be. There's always reference to fraud. You know, if you have a lot of properties in Atlanta, for example, you have to deal with a lot of fraudulent applications, that kind of thing. That's always been a kind of background thing, but that's elevated to this is now a top priority for people all over the country. So that was one surprise. The other one was, I suspect we'll get into this as well, but was this, there's a little bit of a pendulum swing from best of breed back to platform vendors in terms of some of the technology decisions that people were considering. And I think it's maybe a bit instructive for how technology innovation works in our industry.
Do you think that shift from kind of best in breed point solution will swing towards, you know, full stack has anything to do with one of your conclusions just around like revenue trumping everything and everyone probably thinking through expense management, or are there other things that go into why that shift has happened?
I mean, it's probably a factor, but What was interesting when you talk to people about how they acquire technology, nobody's really nobody's really changing anything about how they evaluate technology in service of saving more dollars. That's not how they how people seem to think about it. It's much more like, is the delta between what I can get from my platform vendor and what I get from best of breed big enough that it warrants burning the additional calories on supporting another integration, the support overhead because people at Property call my people, not the vendor's people, whenever something goes wrong. Is that overhead worth the delta that I get between the platform and the best of breed? And you can tell, I mean, there are examples this year where, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, people were firmly of the view that, you know, the stuff that we want to change about our business is so big that we need best of breed to solve that for us. And a couple of years later, it's like, there's the functional gaps have been closed over the last couple of years. This is a tougher decision now than it was a couple of years ago. You can tell that's how you end up in this situation where, you know, it's still the case that most of the technology in this industry is made by either RealPage, Yardi, or AppFolio, right? you can kind of tell why that's the case.
So let's start with fraud. I think it was one of the things that maybe was louder in the guide compared to what you were expecting. And near the end, you have a conclusion section, and on page 46, you have this like massive stat, and it says 93.3% of respondents to the NMHC survey reported experiencing fraud in the last 12 months, which was a 40% lift year over year. I'd love to hear what you heard and what you learned on the fraud front as it related to 20 for 20.
Yeah, well, that surprised me as well. But when I put that in the presentation that I was using to brief the executives that were involved in this as well, and a couple of them said, the real story of this stat is not the 93.3%. It's who's the 6.7% that weren't affected by fraud this year. So this feels to me like a big like COVID hangover, right? What happened during the pandemic was that we had these eviction moratoria. So that created this demand for, you know, information on how to avoid getting evicted or how to benefit as much as possible from the various like legal provisions that have been made. So along come a bunch of social media influencers to help residents with those issues. Well, from there, it's not that big of a step into, all right, well, how do we get around screening, and how do we get around like application checks? And you've now got to the point where it's kind of scarily targeted, right? It's not just how do we get around checks in general. It's how do we get around this company's checks, right? So one company was saying they found there's a TikTok influencer that was publishing content about how to get around their specific process, and it had like, I think it was in the order of 10,000 views before they managed to get it like removed. Wow. So. Couple of things with that. First of all, it's clearly very, and this was not just in the markets where you usually think about a lot of fraud. It's kind of all over the place. That's coupled in many jurisdictions where it's taking like a year to evict people. So I was talking to a Midwest based operator last week about this very issue, and he was saying we've got properties in Atlanta in which there are multiple units that owe us in excess of $50,000 in delinquent rent, and we still can't get rid of these. Residents. So the costs associated with not being able to stop people on the way in are really, really severe for properties. Lots and lots of advice. It's very easy to get hold of fake documents now. You can order a very high quality fake, ID pack for like under $20 or something on the dark web, and you've got all of this tutorial stuff that tells you how to apply. It just doesn't seem tenable to me that companies are going to be able to persist if they're still trying to do that with just manual checks, people eyeballing documents and such. The reason really for that, you know, lots of companies are already trying to, there's a lot of best of breed technology, some very cool technology out there on the good guys side that people are increasingly adopting. But for the companies that don't have that, you're increasingly going to be the gazelle at the back of the pack, right? Because if people are filing fake applications to figure out who's doing which checks, they're going to point people increasingly to the weakest application processes. So this really has all the conditions of an arms race right now.
It's interesting. I mean, I can think of a couple companies in my network that I feel are starting to talk more and more about fraud, but on the technology side, and it could be just since I'm so like connected to the marketing world specifically, I feel like I'm not seeing a lot of thought leadership or education around fraud. Are you seeing that climb in terms of topic in your community, or is that going to be a big opportunity in 2024 and beyond to really like educate on solving and reducing that 93%?
Yeah, so you're absolutely, I mean, it's not just you. It's I don't think, relative to the amount of technology and its capabilities and the variety and ways people are solving this problem, I think this is very is not as well understood as it should be. I'll definitely be doing more work on this. So again, I wasn't even aware of this opportunity until I started putting the this year's report together. But yeah, I definitely plan to dive deep into this in the next few months. It's interesting. You've got some quite substantial differences in the way that you deal with fraudulent applications, right? You can look at people's bank accounts. You can look at the documents. If you're looking at the documents, you've got the content that's written on the document and figuring out whether that's true or not. And then you've got all of these like clues in the code of the PDF that tell you whether or not the document has been doctored. It's a really, really good application for AI because it's just taking thousands and thousands of documents and looking for all these little inconsistencies that enable you to figure out whether something's a true document or not. You've got some really interesting other applications of machine learning, like deep in the application process, right? If you can figure out just from what people are doing when they're keying details into a website, like you can start to spot which applicants look like they're behaving in a manner consistent with fraudsters. And if we know that, you know, the incentives are there for bad actors to find ways to get past people's screening or background check or application checks, you're going to get smarter and smarter in terms of the ways that you trap people's behavior there. So I think it's quite a fast changing and technologically increasingly sophisticated area. So it's something that I think property managers really need to be understanding.
It's interesting. I have kind of gone down this like personal curiosity pursuit the last maybe 3 months where I've started reading more and more of the REIT earnings reports, just to see if I can like learn anything new about trends or kind of hot topics. And could just be that it's like not popular to talk about that in your earnings calls, but I have not read hardly anything. I've read a lot about centralization. I've read a lot about expenses outpacing revenue and needing to claw back, you know, expenses and really protect revenue growth. But that's interesting. And I think call to action for anyone listening that's in that space, like start to speak up, like let's get some podcast content going around this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as a sales guy, I feel like there were some learnings in the guide this year on how clients, operators, owners are thinking about tech evaluations. And I'd love to kind of like hear what you learned and maybe have some dialogue around any action or learning around just the overarching evolution of tech evaluation.
Yeah, well, so we've I'm sure we've spoken about this in either in private or on your podcast before. We tend to gravitate towards I generally sort of gravitate towards stuff that I think is not well understood. Like, so when we think about how we sell to customers, you know, like a few years ago, we asked people how they evaluate how many dollars to spend on technology and on any particular piece of technology. And the interesting finding was we asked about four different types of technology. So across 20 interviews, that's 80 different separate observations. There wasn't a single instance where people had done any numerical analysis of ROI in deciding what software to buy. And again, like if you're trying to sell, you're tending to want to put a spreadsheet together that shows the ROI number, and when I apply a six cap to it, here's the value. Like, you tend to think about things that way if you're a salesperson. But what you realize is that's this is practically never the way that people think about whether or not this is worth the money on the other side of the other side of the table. So that was a really interesting thing a few years ago that really shaped the way I think about this. But the thing I wanted to ask about particularly this year was a year ago, like in when people were looking forward to 2023, because everybody knew that property trading was going to slow down. Efficiency was and managing assets for the NOI for longer than we're used to doing was a big preoccupation. And a lot of people said, this will be a year when we try and eliminate overlap from our tech stack. We're going to be much more rigorous about how we evaluate technology. At the same time, as you and I were talking about earlier, last year it seemed that there were several different companies that were bringing technologies to market that were designed to help manage vendors or manage procurement or sourcing processes. And so I just wanted to get a read on whether or not stuff had changed. So I asked the question about, did anything change about the way that you evaluate technology this year? And it's one of those really good examples where you realize you asked the wrong question, right? Because by asking a question about how you evaluate technology, it's like I was taking a bit of a vendor biased view, right? Because again, if you're a salesperson, you're thinking about how do I sell my technology, you tend to think of it like a beauty contest, right? If I'm selling to Mike, I'm going to tell Mike what's awesome about my product, and he's going to look at all the other products, and he's going to look at them side by side, and then he's going to choose the best one, and they get all of Mike's business, right? That tends to be the framing you put around these things if you're a salesperson. And what you realize is that's very seldom the way that people buy anything. I mean, fraud that we just talked about, that would be one of the good examples of where that probably is something that people are doing this year. It's quite new. Like I may not be doing anything about it right now. I need to be educated on what the competitive offers are in the market, and I want to pick one. But for most categories of technology are not like that at all. Like, so when you ask people about it, they tell you, well, we're a real estate industry, right? So what that means is that not every piece of technology I have is technology that I chose. Lots of technology comes to us by way of partners or by way of real estate acquisitions. So if I'm going to change something about my technology buying habits, it's more likely that I'm trying to get rid of stuff that I'm already familiar with than I'm trying to acquire new stuff. It's much more often the case that people are trying to get to one vendor per category than in their existing technology stack than I'm trying to pick one new vendor of something to bring in. That was probably the main thing. But I mean, those people who were changing anything about the way they evaluate technology were mostly talking about, how do we solve the problem of it's going to be difficult to grow rent this year? Like, so what things are going to give me some offset during this calendar year? Those things are going straight to the top of the list of priorities. So things like managed Wi-Fi. If I've had success with managed Wi-Fi, I probably want to do more, just because it's a non-trivial like ancillary revenue stream. There were people in-housing captive insurance programs and stuff like that. But stuff like that has a really, really high salience right now, just because of the revenue picture through much of the country.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. I feel like it has changed a lot for me in the last 10 years. Like 10 years ago, I felt like there was a lot of emotion in the buying experience and the selling experience, and you could have colors and flash and fun, and that was like oftentimes enough to influence at least some buying decision. And it seems like there's been a ton of evolution I think ROI will get you a meeting, but people aren't necessarily using ROI to buy. I totally agree with you. And I also am seeing more like formalization of just like committees to make sure that you don't have, you know, rogue signatures, because I think the days of a regional manager being able to squeeze a contract and that the business is going to deal with, like, that is changing fast. And so I think committees have really stood up. We're seeing that with a lot of our larger customers with, hey, you know, we don't have this product category on our buying roadmap until Q3, but please reach back out because we'd love to formally, you know, evaluate your program at that point. And as we've like pushed on that, it's like pretty rigid. Like, they're actually putting formal standards around standardization, less rogue property level, you know, but like really standardization across the stack. So it's been fun. It's also made it more challenging to sell, but it's also part of the game, right?
Yeah, it's so the ROI thing, it's interesting that ROI is the thing that you use to convince other stakeholders in your organization. It's a hygiene factor, but it's not, it doesn't drive the decision. It sort of needs to be there so that, you know, your boss or the CFO or whoever it is, like that needs to show up like somewhere. But it's funny that I think the conclusion I drew a couple years ago is that ROI to a salesperson is a number. But ROI to a buyer is a rationale. Like it's the explanation of what's going to change about my business when I use this software. Like that's what, and you know, the sort of conclusion I draw from that, if you're selling, like everybody tells themselves stories about what makes their business more effective. And the better you can get at figuring out what story people tell themselves and make your pitch be about that, that's far more effective than trying to make it be about a spreadsheet. One other thing, actually, I sort of forgot to mention this, but when you talk to people about the technology decisions that they're making, like when they are considering buying new technologies, the stories people tell you, particularly on the operations side, are really interesting. You realize that, you know, again, we're a real estate industry, which means our assets are fixed, our demand is structural. Like half of our product is sold in advance of the year, so this industry is way less susceptible to you're going to increase by X% kind of ideas than most industries would be, just by the nature of what we do. And when you talk to operators about actual decisions that they're making to buy technology, you become aware that they're thinking about this in terms of what things can I change about how my business works that make me better able to capitalize on the opportunities that this year holds. So if you think about something like renewals, super, super important, because, you know, you don't want to lose anybody. You don't have to this year, because who knows whether you even get a neutral lease over lease trade out in most markets. So I might be preoccupied with what I do about renewals. Well, I can improve renewals by pricing better, by having a better process, by offering a better experience, by improving maintenance, because it's very consequential in terms of renewal rates. I can do any number of different things. I typically can't do everything, at least can't do everything well. So the decision that somebody's making is, where am I kind of going to place my bet organizationally this year? And it's where that idea overlaps with some piece of technology that someone's aware of. That's usually where new sales of new functionality seems to happen.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with that. I also think, not to like rewind a couple of minutes, but this like ROI narrative, I think, is like this easy sale on the vendor side. Hey, you deploy us, we'll make this much more money for you. We'll save you this on your turn or whatever it might be. But I think you have to also remember that, you know, your ROI might be in conflict of a strategic initiative for that business. We're trying to centralize. Last year, we saw a lot of property admin. We're hearing more about leasing centralization this year. Hey, we're actively trying to remove work from the site. But in order for your program to get us ROI, it's going to create more work for the site. So I think there's like a lot of conflict there on how you enable ROI. And I think the more you can figure out how to do that through a corporate contact versus a site level contact. But there's a big, big gap there with a lot of the point solutions in our space.
Definitely.
Let's talk about centralization. I think that's become like one of the flagship topic points. And I think you brought a lot of thought leadership to the conversation last year, because, you know, there have been some brands in our space that have built a lot of buzz, rightfully so, around talking about centralization with a focus on leasing. But you showed us last year with a lot of data that there was a lot of opportunity in property admin and in maintenance. And we've seen a lot of technology advancement there, certainly in the last 12 months. It felt like leasing was definitely like higher on the topic, but scattered across property types and things like that. So anyways, long story long, what did you learn about centralization this year?
I think the trend, I mean, the surprise last year was exactly as you said. It was really admin was the thing that it was clearly where the rubber was hitting the road, right? People aspired to, we broke stuff up into maintenance, leasing, and admin, and people aspire to centralize all of them to some extent. Like maintenance looked just very difficult. It's harder to do that than it is the other two. But my intuition going into last year would be that leasing was where people were burning the most calories. And although there's lots of things that people were changing about the about how they run leasing to make it more central, if we define centralization in terms of taking stuff off property and putting it into some more central location, admin functions, so the APM role work was very much further down the path with most of the companies we talked to, and this year it was the same. In fact, that appears, if anything, to have accelerated. And it's interesting. 1 year on, you can tell it's sort of taking shape more than previously. So if I look at admin, couple of telling things. If you I ask people a different question this year. So I ask people to put to imagine a scale from we have decided not to do this through to we've already done it. Where do you place your company on that scale? And admin was very much towards the latter end of this. You know, a sizable chunk of companies had already taken the APM role effectively off-site. Others were in the process of doing it. Another interesting thing about it was admin was the only area when none of the 20 respondents has decided not to do it. They're all either in the process of doing it or they just haven't started their project yet. When you talk about leasing's really interesting, because I think leasing, you're going to see just this really big variety of ways that people do it. Admin, I think we're on a path to, it's going to seem weird after a few years to do stuff like collections and accounting and, deposit handling and all of that stuff at property in a few years. There's no reason why that work needs to be done at the property level. But the main reason people don't move that role offsite is more to do with coverage, like going from three people to two people at property, than it is to do with the actual work. The work itself, there's no reason why it needs to be done at a property at all. Leasing, on the other hand, is different. Like you need some capacity to meet with people. Like if people talk about the UDR model, I guess, as the most sort of centralized, the most self-serve of at least of the people that talk publicly about what they do in the industry. But UDR does lease ups with people, right? You need some capacity to meet people and tour them if that's how they want to lease. And what that means is, if I've got properties that are not that close together, then that means there needs to be at least one person at property where at least part of their job is meeting with people for leasing. So, you've got, I think if we put UDR at one end and status quo at the other, I think everyone's going to be at some point along that continuum where, they're varyingly self-serve, they're varyingly supported by central functions, but they all do it in quite different ways.
It's interesting hearing you say that. I feel like over the last year, I've gotten more and more interested in third-party mechanics of how those businesses grow. I've become really good friends with some of the biggest sales leaders on the third-party side. We probably know all the same names there. And I've asked if I could see some of the pitch decks. And it's interesting. I feel like it's such a polarizing conversation right now, because there is this like pointy end of company that have gone all in tech-enabled services, and outside of lease ups, they are really trying to go human less on site. Mm-hmm. And then you're seeing a lot of companies say, hey, no, we're full of humans on site. And as we try to combat this retention narrative, we're doubling down on people. So it's interesting. I love the debate. I love the conversation. I obviously believe in harnessing technology, but it'll be interesting to see what normal looks like as you reference the status quo, because I think that status quo has stayed firmly put in we're all in on people on site.
Yeah, the third party model is fascinating. Like this would move a lot quicker, but for the fact that you've got these third party arrangements in there. And as I was writing a lot like last year, the industry is getting more third party managed every year. Like the last decade, far more properties are part of a third party ownership. Management arrangement than was the case 10 years ago. Well, that means a couple of things. First of all, it builds this natural inertia into the model, right? Because every property has a pro forma where both parties have signed up to it, which means how many calories do you really want to burn changing something that everybody's broadly happy with, as long as we're exceeding or at least meeting pro forma? Do I really need to reinvent my staffing model at that property, or would I rather spend my time going and finding more deals? I think we know what the answer is usually going to be to that question. So I think you're going to find more. It's only in 2023 that I started to hear about companies, some, and it's a minority, small minority of third-party management companies offering centralized formulas for staffing, right? So I can think of maybe three or four companies Yep. where you've got a choice of we can staff the property the old-fashioned way, or here's a menu of centralized services, and you can buy it on a per unit per month basis rather than just biting off one FTE at a time. It's just like, well, if you take these services, you sort of buy them the way you would buy SaaS software or something, right? Instead, that looks like quite a new model in the industry. So I'm super interested to see how it works out. But you would think that if a third party manager has enough density in some markets and is successful enough in getting new deals to sign up to a model like that, I don't see why that doesn't become way more compelling than just always doing the 1-to-100 FTE model that we're used to.
Yeah, well said. Hey, I want to be mindful of time, but I did want to at least hit on one more, and then we can see if there's anything we missed. AI, I think, has been a fascinating conversation, both as a consumer and as a technology provider in the space. And I'd say that your guide made it really clear this year that everyone's thinking about it. Not everyone is harnessing it. And the vendors seem to really be in charge of the strategy, like harnessing and deploying most of the actual AI into the prop tech motion. But what were some of your findings, learnings, and how are you thinking about AI heading into the meat and potatoes of 2024?
Yeah, I actually think when we think about adoption, it looks really similar to what we've seen with centralization, in that people naturally gravitate towards customer-facing problems. And so it's no surprise that most of the best of breed technology out there is handling digital leasing systems, the lead nurturing, collections, increasingly like service related stuff as well, is really good applications of conversational AI. People very much see that as something that you buy from third parties. Nobody's working on the problem of, okay, well, how do we leverage like open AI or somebody else's large language model to solve these problems? This is something that you go to a specialist vendor who does just that to acquire these capabilities. It's interesting when you think about the way people buy technology. There is this sort of calculus that if I think this results in more rent, more leases, more renewals, like it's worth taking a punt on, right? It doesn't matter if we increase our per door spend on technology if we think there's a decent chance that it's going to give us any of those revenue driving metrics, right? That's the way incentive structure works in the industry. So it's no surprise at all. And that, and the fact that, you know, conversational AI is a way better way of dealing with anything that involves nagging human beings. it's sort of obvious to see why people have gravitated towards those problems. The people who are sort of thinking about, all right, well, what does adoption of something like OpenAI, like ChatGPT, like look like? They're tending to think about back office problems, right? So, all right, how do we use chat to power our help desk? You know, how do we replace some of the more burdensome calls, repetitive calls, with sort of chat that we get from a third party, a large language model? The most sophisticated people we spoke to are thinking about, or in some cases testing, like solutions like that. But again, it does look like the way that people think about centralization, right? When you really start to think about what can I do in my business to improve my business with this new capability, you sort of gravitate towards these like high friction, relatively low value add problems, and that tends to be, you know, the low hanging fruit that people really exploit. Even though the technology that they mostly buy is stuff that's related to sales and marketing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because I think conversational AI seems to be like the table stakes right now, where you can deploy that to either offset internal or external just hours spent to triage customer, you know, queries. But I think the bar is getting raised pretty quickly in the enterprise. Like, I look at how I'm interacting with Delta now, it is largely humanless and it's great. Like, in terms of how I'm changing flights, or I'm getting on standby, or I'm asking for an upgrade. And so I do think there's this important customer experience to balance, to make sure that as you're deploying any sort of conversational AI into this industry, that it can match the consumer expectation. And I've dabbled in some that have been, you know, stellar, and some that have been quite the opposite. So I'm really fascinated. I think it's going to be a fun couple years, and I think we'll see a couple headlines probably departmentalized this year that are going to be really like aligned with a couple of these things we've talked about today.
Yeah, it's the opportunities that I see just in terms of how people are thinking about this. First of all, you've got different AIs doing more and more different stuff across the customer lifecycle. I feel like the penny that has to drop is that people begin to view the lifecycle as the opportunity. So I think I said in the book, collections is a really good use case for conversational AI. It's a much better use case for a conversational AI that knows your entire history of maintenance requests and knows all of the preferences you expressed when you were searching for an apartment and so on. So, you know, that's a really exciting opportunity. Like, there's just this reality in our business, we turn over staff a lot. And that is just always this hindrance to customer experience, right? But if you've got this layer of really immediate, like, intelligence that just sort of knows you and kind of gets you, that's thinking about it from the lifestyle perspective, I think, is a really, really big opportunity for companies. And I'm not sure that many are thinking about it right now, but I feel like, you know, by the end of this year, lots of people will be. The other thing that was curious is that nobody expresses an opinion when you talk to them about this on what delineates a good versus a less good solution. You know, normally people have really strong opinions on the technology that they chose and why they chose it. You really don't hear that at all about AI. So again, if I'm talking to a software vendor who's in that space, I think my current advice is, like, I suspect there's just a really, really strong first mover advantage in this space. I don't get the impression that people are really thinking about, well, what's the difference between these solutions and how they work? Okay, I'm going to go with this one. It's much more, it's much more black boxy right now. Whether people get more familiar with this as the year goes on, we will see. But it's not an it's not a technology where people are under the hood in the same way that they are with other things.
I completely agree. Well, hey, in terms of today's discussion, are there any topics from the guide you want to hit on before we wrap up?
Not really. I mean, we didn't talk about, maybe we touched on it earlier, but I do think revenue is this really big deal. I mean, sorry, revenue is always a big deal, but like the supply dynamics, it's very odd that you have so many markets where you've got really, really strong fundamentals. Like you'd normally kill for fundamentals like those that you see in the Sun Belt right now. But the amount of new supply is just so enormous that that we manage to have like revenue problems for the foreseeable future. I do think that that's going to change a lot about what people's priorities are during the course of the year. I think you're going to have to compete hard. I know people have told me who are in like the Northeast and the Sun Belt. They've told us that there are like a couple of percentage points already. You can see in average occupancies across portfolios that they have. So you can tell you're going to have to compete much harder for renewals. You know, if someone's coming up for renewal and they're being offered brand new product to, you know, same money or maybe even less than they're paying currently, like those are circumstances that we're not used to in the industry. So I think stuff like that is really going to force people to do some different stuff this year, which I think is going to be really interesting to watch. I think like there was actual interest in revenue management this year, which there hasn't been like historically. Revenue management, I mean, besides all the stuff that's going on externally, like the technology has been very settled for a lot of years now in the industry, and you actually see people now looking around for different ways to solve some of the problems that revenue management hasn't historically dealt with all that well. You know, revenue management's never really handled concessions, lease-ups, particularly in challenging markets. You've got so many lease-ups in such suboptimal circumstances right now. There's an interest in looking to revenue management to do more work than it historically has in that area. So yeah, that's an area that I definitely have my eye on this year as well. But I do think that whole revenue dynamic is going to change people's plans for this year.
Yeah, I completely agree. Is that something that's being talked about broadly, like on stage right now, or is that more of a board level conversation? I'm hearing about it broadly in terms of like expenses versus revenue growth, the need to kind of forecast concessions as you kind of prepare for new supply to enter a market, getting ahead of renewals. But are you seeing like a lot of chatter about that at the executive level in broad groups right now, or is that more of a private discussion?
I'm not seeing it much in externally, but it's very much a, depending on which markets you're in, I think fraud and how do we deal with, you know, stagnant rent growth are probably the biggest sort of factors that I hear people talking about.
Okay. Well, if anybody wants to download 20 for 20, arguably the best white paper of the year in multifamily, they can head to 20for20.com. I'll link to your LinkedIn as well, Dom. And third time we've done this, I think this is our best one yet. Awesome. I just want to say thank you for sharing the time with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure, and I love the pod.
All right. Chat soon.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.